community there at the hands of the occupation and extremist settlers?
Yes, so the way that we see it as Palestinians is Palestine operates as a community, and that's regardless of religion. But what I've seen personally living there is that Palestinians, Christians, Muslims, they face oppression on a daily basis, and it's the same oppression. The Christians don't get spoken about enough, which I think is tactical, but they go through the same land grabs, settler violence on a daily basis, streets they're not allowed to walk down just because they're Palestinian, regardless of their religion, facing the IOF on a daily basis, their children also getting imprisoned and arrested for false trumped-up charges, apart from the fact that, you know, Palestinians in the West Bank also get killed quite frequently, regardless, again, of religion. The Zionists can't tell what religion you are by looking at you, and so, therefore, the Christians are persecuted the same way as any other Palestinian, hence why we say that we're a community made up of different religions. It's a lack of freedom of movement for the Christian Palestinians and Muslim Palestinians. It's a lack of religious right to practice your religion, whether going to churches or mosques. It's the same persecution that they face. I think the issue that we have is that the Christians don't get spoken about a lot because of the fact that it goes against Israel's agenda of making this a Muslim Jewish issue, where actually it's a Palestinian against Israel issue, regardless, again, of religion. So, like I said, we are one community and we act in that way. And the Palestinian Christians and Muslims go through the same thing.
It's definitely something that we've seen, the unity between the Christians and the Palestinians, you know, on footage that has gone viral, but also in cases like Shireen Abu Akleh, who, is one of our most beloved and treasured heroines of the Palestinian liberation, doing her job and obviously attacked in cold blood and murdered by the entity. But also something that you said that was really striking to me is I found myself surprised to hear of, although I've seen it, and as a Palestinian I've grown up seeing it, I was still surprised to hear just how much repression the Christian community is suffering. And that's upsetting. It's almost like this, you know, internalized colonization that I'm fighting. Reverend, if I can come to you for this question, as a religious leader, I'm sure that you have seen and heard these things that we've just spoken about, what Amira has attested to. But you know, we know that scholars of all Abrahamic faiths have long been the targets of pro-apartheid lobbies who have launched heavy campaigns to have them displaced from their roles if they speak about Palestine. Can you tell us about why religious leaders are targets? And if you have any experience in this matter, set the scene for us.
Well, Israel is an apartheid state. It's based on supremacism. It's a racist endeavor. And it's a settler colonial enterprise. And that's an indefensible political position. And therefore, it must make its critics, particularly those committed to human rights, it must make them appear worse to distract attention from its own crimes. So it accuses Jewish anti-Zionists, for example, as Jew haters. And it accuses non-Jews like me and others as either Holocaust deniers or anti-Semites. The way they've achieved this is by pushing a misdefinition of anti-Semitism. It's called the IHRA, the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance misdefinition. It's a working definition. It was never intended to be used in legal terms. But it essentially dilutes anti-Semitism from prejudice, hostility, racism towards Jews because they're Jews, but equates similar criticisms of Israel as anti-Semitism, which is entirely fallacious. It's untrue. But by imposing this new definition on particularly Western governments, churches, trade unions, universities, they have broadened out this definition. So if you criticize Israel, they'll accuse you of being anti-Semitic. In my own personal experience, I've faced 20 years or more of intimidation, where they target or critical of you, accusing you of associating with anti-Semites or Holocaust deniers and so on. One occasion, they accused me of seeking to divert church funds to Hamas in Gaza, which is entirely untrue. But they intimidate you. And if that doesn't work, they intimidate others to try and isolate you. So invitations to speak in universities or churches suddenly will be withdrawn because pressure has been put upon them not to have you speak. I encountered a complaint that was made about me in 2012, accusing me of anti-Semitism. That was resolved amicably, but then they had another go in 2018, and that led to a tribunal. It took 4 years. They couldn't find a single person to come and be a witness against me. I had 50 witnesses on my side, rabbis, academics, bishops. They couldn't find a single word of mine that was deemed anti-Semitic, and yet the tribunal found me guilty of conduct unbecoming, gave me a 12-year suspension from being an Anglican priest, so much so that one Jewish academic, Jeff Halper, called it an inquisition, and the expert witness on anti-Semitism at my tribunal, Anthony Lerman, said it's an indelible stain on the Church of England to accuse someone who's never uttered a single word against the Jews to be accused of anti-Semitism. So that's how they do it. They target academics, they target politicians like Jeremy Corbyn and clergy. And if they get one scalp, one head, everyone else keeps their heads down. And that's part of their agenda, to silence criticism where really criticism needs to be directed at them.
What an interesting story, and something that I'm sure many other religious leaders have similar stories like yourself. What I'd like to do now is have us all take a look at some examples of how Christians and their beliefs are denigrated by the Zionist Jewish occupiers of Palestine.
The genocide against the Palestinian people has brought Judaism and Jewish extremism into the spotlight. From extremist rabbis calling for Christians to be killed,
2 billion Christians, which are idol worshippers, between Chinese, Indian, Hindus, Buddhists, and Christian, at least 6.5 billion people are idol worshippers that, according to the Torah, do not have the right to live. Idol worshiper goy, it's death penalty. Not only Jews, even a goy who bow down to an idol, who believe in JC, deserve death penalty.
In my country.
To ordinary Israelis making the same murderous threats.
Are you Jewish? Do you want to honor God? That is the godly thing to do. We respect one another.
The godly thing to do is to kill you.
The godly thing is to kill me.
That's right. That's what the Torah says.
The Torah says to kill us.
The Torah says that people who worship idols such as yourself, when there is a Sanhedrin,
to kill us.
Yes.
Okay.
That's what the Torah says.
So we know how the Jewish people feel about Christians, yes? That you discriminate against Christians.
Christians are idol worshippers.
You discriminate against Christians.
The Torah says that Christianity is idol worship.
You also have the same rabbis making threats to destroy churches.
Even if the United States government would say, okay, hey, you're becoming too fanatic, the government, too religious. We'll give you $1 billion extra every year to the aid. Don't touch the churches. We're not allowed to listen to them. God comes before Obama and his friends.
While it appears that for the Jewish extremist squatters in Palestine, spitting on Christians is a favored pastime. Then there is the outright blasphemy against Jesus and his pure mother.
Reverend, if I can come to you again for this question, the persecution that you've faced, I'm assuming, is a parallel that you can draw between yourself, the Christian Palestinians, but also Jesus as well faced similar persecution by the people of his time. Can you give us some information on that and draw some parallels for us?
I'd be pleased to. The parallels are quite significant. The first century Judaism was under foreign military occupation, the Roman Empire, and the political and religious leaders, people like Herod, the king, and the Pharisees and Sadducees, the religious leaders, were cooperating with the Roman government and oppressing the people. They were used as a means of oppressing and taxing the people. And so the parallels with Zionism today, with supremacism, with antagonism toward the poor, the marginalized, and the foreigners, the parallels are clear. Jesus was a threat to that. Even before he was born, his mother, Mary, when she was told that she was expecting him. It's called Mary's Song. She speaks about how he will bring down the rulers from their thrones. He will lift up the humble. He will fill the hungry with good things and send the rich away empty. After Jesus was born, King Herod recognized there was a threat when the Magi from Iran visited Bethlehem to worship Jesus and give him gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. Herod instituted a pogrom to try and have Jesus murdered as a baby. He had orders given to kill all the boys in Bethlehem under the age of two because he saw Jesus as a threat. As an adult, Jesus' very first sermon given in Nazareth speaks of how he would proclaim freedom for prisoners, recovery of sight to the blind, set the oppressed free, and proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. The year of the Lord's favor was the Jubilee, the time when slaves would be freed, when debts would be canceled, and that was what he was coming to do, to bring a revolution to the status quo. He anticipated persecution in his Sermon on the Mount, probably his most famous sermon. He says, "You'll be blessed if you are persecuted for righteousness' sake. Blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, falsely say all kinds of evil against you. Rejoice and be glad, for great is your reward in heaven. For in the same way they persecuted the prophets." As we follow through the life of Jesus as an adult, we see him challenging the religious leaders, challenging the status quo, the foreign rulers, turning the tables in the temple, casting out those who were exploiting the poor. And on one occasion, they tried to trap Jesus, and they said, "Should we pay taxes to Caesar?" And Jesus said, "Show me a coin." And they gave him a coin, and he said, "Whose image is on the coin?" And they all shouted out, "Caesar's." He said, "Well, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and render to God the things that are God's." He was pointing out that they were using this money, therefore they were already compromising with the government, the Roman government. Yes, pay your taxes, but remember your responsibility is ultimate to God, and he is sovereign. At his trial, Pilate challenged Jesus and said, "Don't you realize I can have you killed?" And Jesus said, "You would have no authority were it not given you from God himself. God is sovereign. God is in control." All through the life of Jesus, we see how he antagonized and challenged those who were committed to a supremacism, committed to the status quo, using their power to exploit particularly the vulnerable.
And everything that you've just said about, you know, Jesus, may peace and blessings be upon him, and his, you know, his fight and his resilience in fighting his oppressors is actually something that we've all seen of the Palestinians currently, whether it be Christian, Muslim, or even our Jewish Palestinian community, fighting the IOF, and, you know, doing so with so much dignity and so much honor. You know, Amira, if I can come back to you, footage that we've, you know, seen of Christians in Palestine being insulted and being spat on, etc., by the community, it's gone viral. It's not new. You know, this, yet they are, as a community, you know, Israel kind of, what it does is that it propagates itself as this, the only democracy in the Middle East where everyone has their freedoms, whether it be in the religious sector or in the personal sector. What do settlers and their patrons in the Israeli regime really think about Christians, you know, from your own experience, from what you've seen?
To sum it up, I think an unwanted nuisance, because if it, it again goes against their agenda, having Christians in Palestine, where they want to, you know, make it very obvious that it's a Muslim problem, and having the Christians there is an issue, which is one of the reasons why systematically they've been pushed out, whether that be in Jerusalem or West Bank. and the population is dwindling. So if we look at, for example, in 1922, there was 10% population, a Christian population in the whole of the land, whereas now it's estimated 2% in the whole of the land. And these people aren't running away from their Palestinian brothers and sisters, but regardless of religion. They're running away from being systematically attacked by the settlers, by the regime in general, whether that's persecution, whether that's, you know, not allowing them to practice their religion, and constantly taking from them, whether it, you know, their lands, their homes. They face the same things on a daily basis as the Muslims. So I think how they see, how settlers and the regime sees them is a population in Palestine that needs to go. It needs to be pushed into Jordan. It needs to be pushed into other surrounding countries because that fits their agenda. And we've seen it. We've seen their percentage. I mean, they weren't too many to begin with. And, you know, we have to remember, these are the most ancient Christians in the world that we have in Palestine. And they need to be respected and looked after because at the moment they are facing a real threat of extinction.
Absolutely.
And, you know, if we don't look after them and show the Western world what's happening to them, in the next 20, 30 years, we do face, we face the fact that there might not be any ancient Christians that are related to the past biblical stories on the land that Jesus was born in.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's definitely something that the Muslim community in Palestine feel very strong about. It's, you know, there has been conversations back and forth of if our mosques are bombed, you know, Christian priests have said that we will make the call for Adhan and we will be the ones to honour Islamic prayer to for the community. And the same, and the inverse is true, whereas the Muslims have said if no churches exist, you know, we will make sure to honour the traditions of Christianity in the land. Reverend, thank you so much for joining us, and the same for you, Amira. This is such an enlightened conversation, and I wish that we had more time to continue it, but unfortunately that is all that we have time for today. Thank you at home, and join us again next week for another edition of Eye on Islam. Assalamu alaikum.
علي حبه جنة وسيم النار والجنة وسي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Alhamdulillahi rabbil alamin. Wassalatu wassalamu ala sayyidina Muhammadin wa ala ahli baytihi at-tayyibin at-tahirin. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the topic of a guide to managers based on the teachings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. We are currently focusing on the letter number 54 of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha, which is the letter that he wrote to Malik Ashtar, who was the governor of Egypt, who was actually assigned to be the governor of Egypt. And when he was going to Egypt, Imam Ali alayhi salam gave him a letter with very, very beautiful pieces of advice regarding how to manage the affairs and how to govern. And we talked about the fact that Imam Ali alayhi salam, in one of the phrases, begins to address the issue of human resources and people that are working under you as a manager. He goes on to say, "And فَاسْتَعْمِلْهُمْ اِخْتِبَارًا وَفَاسْتَعْمِلْهُمْ اِخْتِبَارًا." That means make use of them and put them into your system, but through examining them first and having a process of checks and balances. That's how you make use of them.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, Imam Ali alayhi salam, the next phrase goes on to say, وَلَا تُوَلِّهِمْ مُحَابَاتًا وَأَثَرَةً. That do not give them authority, or do not accept them under your authority. مُحَابَاتًا وَأَثَرَةً. مُحَابَاتًا means do not accept them to work for you or to be in the system. مُحَابَاتًا, that means out of kindness. You know, sometimes you are the head of a company, or let's say you have a private business, right? And there is someone of your family who doesn't have a job. So out of kindness, you put him inside your system and inside your company. Well, that is okay, because this is your private personal job, okay? You can put anyone you want. But sometimes it's not like that. Sometimes you are working for the government. You are a representative of the people. You are working in an institute that is working for the needs and requirements of the general public. In such a situation, you can't just, out of kindness, put someone there inside your company. Let's say you're working even for a government office or whatever. You know, there are many institutes of those kinds, you know. Here, Imam Ali Islam clearly tells him, وَلَا تُوَلِّهِمْ مُحَابَاتًا. Out of kindness, that we know he's my relative or he's my friend, son, or, you know, things like that. You can't do that. Or sometimes, no, it's a sensitive job. Let's say you have a medical institute. Inside you have surgeons, okay? Very, you need advanced surgeons there. And then you have your, for example, your friend's son or your friend himself who is a surgeon, but he's not an expert of that kind. He has made some mistakes in the past and he doesn't have that integrity. You can't say, okay, because he's my friend, I'll invite him and let him work with him or work with me. If you do that just because out of kindness, then it is a kind of a breach of trust towards the people. So that is one thing. Or sometimes it's maybe that person has done a favor on you. And that's why it's very important that people in power need to be careful who they take favors from. Right? So, because this person has done a favor on me, now I'm returning the favor by accepting him inside the office. This is absolutely wrong. This is incorrect. And one of the problems is that, for example, we have a group of people that voted for me. Let's say you have a friend of yours who really worked hard to vote for you. For example, he gathered, he has a company and he gathered large amounts of people to vote for you. Now you feel, oh my God, now this guy wants to be in the government. But I know he has no managerial skills. I know he is not fit for office. What do I do? This is a test, a very big test. Imam Ali alayhi salam says, وَلَا تُوَلِّهِمْ مُحَابَاتًا.
IRIB English Radio presents a detailed commentary of the Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him, on the program Gate of Knowledge.
Now, Imam Ali alayhi salam very beautifully brings this discussion. وَلَا تُوَلِّهِمْ مُحَابَاتًا. Do not put them inside your government out of kindness, just because of some kind of emotional considerations or because of some kind of reciprocation. No, that doesn't work. You know, they helped vote for me, so now I need to be kind to them. The same can be talked about today in what Israel is doing in America, right? So what if the Israeli lobby is helping you collect votes or giving you money? Does that mean that they need to be given authority in different areas of the government and create problems for the society? Of course not. So sometimes, you know, I mean, we can have different examples in different governments of the world today. Just see and observe. You'll see there are certain lobbies, let's say, so-called lobbies, that help you get votes, that give you some money and do things like that. And then how do you react to them? Do you listen to them? Do you put them into your system of governing? Or do you base your governance on integrity, on true principles? How do you govern? That's very important. وَلَا تُوَلِّهِمْ مُحَابَاتًا. This is a plague and a problem in today's governments. Wherever you go, in whichever, unfortunately, most of the countries, unfortunately, have this problem. And we need to try to find a solution for this. Imam Ali alayhi salam is giving us that solution. That when you want to choose someone, then be careful of who you bring into your systems. Be careful, because this is not your private ownership. A government, a social institute is not your private ownership in a way that you can do whatever you want with and you can keep anyone inside. And then he goes on to say, وَأَثْرَةً. And don't also choose people أَثْرَةً. That means out of your own opinions. Just being opinionated about how you choose people. Inshallah, we shall discuss this in the coming session. That what does it mean here when he says that do not choose people just based on your own opinions. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
قال النبي محمد من كنت مولاه هذا علي سيد فاز من ولاه هو بالكتاب مسدد والنور معناه باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من ناداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال مناه هو في الشدائد منجد والفضل يمناه هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي رباه.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. a warm salam and greetings and peace to all of you, dear brothers and sisters in faith, and to the Imam of our time, Imam Mahdi, whom we are waiting for. And a warm salam to our dear guest in the studio, Sister Salma Khalfan. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you so much.
Thank you for accepting our invitation. Here we are in the IRIB English Radio, talking about the challenges and the problems that parents come across with regards to their little ones. And specifically in the past episodes, we've been talking about the laziness of our teenage children, the problem that you see a lot in our time, that despite the fact that our children know so much, but still, they're still lazy. So, we have to really find a solution to be able to handle them. So previously, we've been talking about the psychological aspect. You mentioned that we shouldn't be making our children dependent from a very young age, even if it entails having your house in a mess or letting the child eat on its own or choose the clothes or whatever. Do it so that later on in the teenage phase of their life, you wouldn't be facing with this problem. Are there any other aspects to the, to the psychological aspect that you'd like to share with us?
Yes, there's one other one, that is lack of motivation. This is a whole topic in itself that, inshallah, we'll discuss maybe after this question, inshallah. So lack of motivation comes about due to many factors, and how to cure that and how to handle with that is also a big process, So we'll, inshallah, come to that. But one is the lack of motivation. Lack of motivation means the lack of feeling like to do something, the lack of feeling that there's a result in that, the lack of happiness in doing it, the lack of feeling that there is something that would applaud, something that would make it be recognized, And normally it's a satanic ruse. It's something that Shaitan really likes instilling in mu'mineen, in everyone in general, but especially mu'mineen, because inshallah that mu'mineen mainly are for the goal of doing everything they do, even the daily activities, even the jobs that they do, whether it be a secular or religious job or secular subject or pursuing education, any kind of activity. And you see, Islam is a way of life, is gold and geared towards earning the pleasure of Allah. So see, this lack of motivation may curl up to a person as young as a teenager who doesn't feel that there is some kind of use of going through this kind of education. For example, giving these exams, studying. After that, what? I'm going to the gym and I will, train myself and become physically strong. Then what? This is how it happens. So they don't find an answer to that, and then they lack the motivation. In us as adults, it also comes sometimes that we pray, we fast, we do everything, we go according to the Islamic principles that Allah has told us, or we do everything in life. But then everything becomes so, a monotonous, such a kind of a habit that we feel in the long run, what? One day I'll die and everything will just, finish. So that motivation dies down. Well, we don't know one thing, that why are we doing this? And that's why, niyat and intention is very vital in everyone's, amal, whether they be just the normal amal, the normal chores of life, or something that you're doing it qurbatan ilallah, like praying. Everything should be geared towards earning the pleasure of Allah. Whether it be eating, drinking, sleeping, going to meet a friend, going for a walk, going for exercise, anything that you do, cooking your food, having, a good gathering, going to somebody's house to meet them. Everything in Islam is like a reward. If you do it for the pleasure of Allah. And that motivation goes away when you don't do it for the pleasure of Allah.
Thank you so much. Let's go for a short break and we'll be back.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear brothers and sisters in faith. We've been talking about the importance of having motivation and teaching motivation to our children as a way to prevent them from being lazy. Well, how can I instill positive, godly, divine motivation in my child? Like, should I say, okay, child, look, if you want to do something, say Bismillah, do it for God, or should I be a role model for them?
Both of them. Both of them is very important, but we'll talk that at length, inshallah. All in all, is from a young age, instill this kind of, behavior in a child that everything we do is useful if it's something that is for our benefit in this life. Even wearing clothes, even going to have a bath, even brushing our teeth, talking to a friend, making friends, going to school, coming back from school, resting, sleeping, everything we can remind them and put a color of Allah in that, the color of godliness in that, to make the child feel that this is not something that he's doing just for himself or for anything else. He's doing it for a cause, a purpose. He's doing it for qurbatan ilallah, and that will make that deep pleasure enter his heart from a young age. That why eating this eating with Bismillah will give you that positive energy to do the best. The best of actions, you can become so, clever whilst you get that positive energy in you. Mm-hmm. All these things have to be ingrained from a very young age. Yes, you're right. And being a role model, of course, that comes, everything under the umbrella. We should be the role model to cultivate this good habit in our children. That I'm not doing this just for the sake of, for example, inviting people, making a cake, or giving a party to a birthday party to my friend or my daughter or whatever. All this is because Allah loves that family unity, family relationship. So it is a maqsad. It's not done just today and then tomorrow you forget it. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I totally agree with you. And I think we can instill this quality, or at least introduce this quality to them through stories of figures in novels, like for instance, stories of the Prophet, Quranic stories, or stories of the martyrs, the shuhada.
Exactly. Yes.
And because it's like oftentimes when you just directly tell something to your child, it would be hard for them to like grasp the concept of God or something, yes, an outer. Yeah.
That's right. That's why I said it should begin from a very young age, and we should be the best role models for them. Then they will also ask questions, mm-hmm. that, for example, why are we doing this? Is it of use? Yes, it's mm-hmm. of much use. For example, creativity in a subject. If you go and see, they're just doing creative works, making necklaces, beads and things like that. So, one says that I don't want to do this kind of thing, but I'm forced to. Mm-hmm. I don't want to do arts, but I'm forced to. So then you can explain them about arts. The arts is such a big place in our history. And how we can do arts of so and so, like such and such things. We can see, when we see cartoons and animation of these kind of things, good cartoons, we get to learn so much. Nothing is futile in this world. Nothing is unnecessary. If Allah has given us this power of imagination, why? To imagine and to create, to do these kind of khidmat and service to the mankind. You can explain so much at their own level, of course.
Yeah.
So they won't find these things something that is nonsensical or something that is of no use. Everything will take meaning. And when everything takes meaning, everything is done with motivation.
Right.
Even tying the shoelaces.
Right. Let's go for a short break and we'll be back.
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam said, "Honor your children and teach them good manners."
Welcome back, dear brothers and sisters. We've been talking about laziness and how to get rid of this quality. And, you know, actually we've been talking about first going to the roots of the problem. Once knowing it, then it will be so much easier to solve it. So Sister Salma Khalfan have been sharing, like she says that sometimes our children don't want to do something because they don't see the final purpose or the final destination where they're heading. Like it's like, why should I study? Like, why should I study for this exam? Why should I go to the gym? Why should I go for a walk? So you explain to them, you show them the final image, the, like the real picture, right? Because they have very limited experience, our children, right? Yeah. And I think by explaining to them and taking to them to experience things themselves,
yeah.
You know, I think we parents talk too much to our children.
That's right. No, there's a whole empowerment here, a process of empowering them
uh-huh.
with this motivation.
Mm-hmm. So what other factors can we discuss?
One of them is weakness of will.
Mm.
When they decide to do something, you'll see them that they start something and they cancel it. For example, this causes laziness, that is. They want to start reading a book. They're so excited about it. They finish just two pages and they see that the words are hard or some vocabulary. They don't understand. They shut the book and that's it. They want to learn a language. They see that it's getting harder now with time. They leave the course halfway. You know, mm-hmm. they would like to study, for example, some other thing. For example, they start going for football or soccer or tennis or skating, whatever. They see that they couldn't do much, gymnastics or something, and they just give up and they say, no, I can't do it.
So how should
lack of will, you see. Here we suggest that you increase the willpower of the child. How to increase the willpower of the child is that, first of all, you encourage them that, you know, this is not the end. If you start, before even you start, you talk to the child that, do you want to enter this, for example, this course or this, do you want to buy this book? And then cut it into small portions. For example, if it's reading a book, okay, and he finds it that it's very difficult for him, you read it together with him in small, small portions
mm-hmm.
so that he develops his will. And then you also show him that, you know, the end result of something is like a feeling of an achievement.
Mm-hmm.
For example, if, for example, he goes for gymnastics and is not able to do it, refer to him, like, for example, refer to the teacher, the instructor, and, you know, talk to the instructor to encourage him to do it. And if, for example, he's just not able to do it and it's not because of laziness, then of course, you know, let him give up on that. But you'll see such lazy children, they start off something and then they don't finish. It starts off with home only. Mm-hmm. They start with something, they start, for example, they want to start studying. And they'll see after 5 minutes, they just feel that they don't want to study. Get along with them. Do it together with them. You know, for example, if it's studying and you see you have left the child independent, first you have to try this scheme of making the child independent.
Yeah.
Okay, study on your own. When he's as much as old as 13-year-old, you can't just keep on, you know, like being with him always or her always. They have to learn to study themselves also. You know, studying yourself starts at the age of 9, 10. It is possible, an issue.
Yeah.
It's not something that is a far-fetched idea. No,
yeah.
It's possible. So when you see that they are not moving forward, then you also get along with them and try to make it, you know, like the process easy and active for them.
Yeah. Thank you so much. We've run out of time. And inshallah, we will continue with the topic of laziness in our future episodes of Islamic Upbringing. And may Allah shower His blessings upon you and your family. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
The conversation.
Hello, I'm Sean Murray, and this is The Conversation, where we take an alternative look at political events and current affairs through an Irish lens. In this show, we hope to pick, probe, investigate, and uncover the stories that you want to hear. We go where mainstream won't go. This week we look at Ireland and its love affair with Europe. In this post-Brexit era, how has Britain's departure from the EU affected the relationship between Old Bledie and its closest neighbours? What is the future for the north of Ireland? My next guest is a former member of the European Parliament, a former political prisoner, and current Sinn Féin politician. As always, we are joined by our resident co-presenter, Michelle Gildenew. Michelle is the current MP for Fermanagh South Tyrone. She has served in the Northern Ireland Assembly as a former Minister for Agriculture and Rural Development and chairperson of the Health Committee, amongst other things. Michelle has been a Sinn Féin activist since her teens and has been elected almost continuously since 1998. And today's guest is Martina Anderson. Martina is a woman well known not to mince her words on the political stage. A straight shooter, some would say. After serving 13 years as an IRA prisoner, Martina joined Sinn Féin, where she went on to become a member of the European Parliament. Martina Anderson, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
So, Martina, could you tell me about your childhood growing up in Derry?
I would describe it as a child of the Battle of the Bogside. I lived in the row of houses, which has now got the iconic wall. You're now entering Free Derry. And by the age of 1969, there had been 14 unionist bombs planted, electricity stations, RTE, water installations, and there were 6 people killed. And I come from a family of 10, and my older brothers and sisters had taken to the streets for one man, one vote, for civil rights, basic houses, jobs, what people were looking for. Most modest demands, one might say, and they were beat off the streets, as we all know. And it used to be written on the walls across Derry and across the north that the IRA equaled I ran away. There was no defence. The community was crying out for people to protect us against a state that neither wanted or welcomed us. So I grew up knowing that there was something rotten at the core of where I lived. I probably didn't have much of an understanding that it obviously was beyond Derry. It's a kind of environment that as a child I grew up in, and all of that had happened before Bloody Sunday.
And Martina, you then joined the IRA yourself, and you were then captured in England. Can you tell me about your capture and your time in jail there?
I'd previously been arrested in Derry, and I was in Armagh during the second hunger strike when that started. So I got bail, and I went on the run after 10 or 11 months. I attended every funeral of the hunger strikers that had taken place in 1981. And between that period and the period of my arrest, we will remain blank. I was arrested in Scotland along with Ella Dwyer and 3 other comrades, and we were charged, all of us were charged with conspiracy to cause explosions in England, and Pat McGee was charged separately with the Brighton bombing. So the 5 of us ended up in Brixton Prison. I was Ella and I were the only two women and 800 men. We didn't expect to be put on remand in Brixton Prison. When we rocked up that day and we were shouting goodbye to the others, saying we'd see them in court, we expected to go to a women's prison in Holloway. But they said it wasn't secure enough for us, and we ended up in Brixton Prison. Brixton Prison was a nightmare for 13 months. Apart from the Category A prisoners, and I do have to differentiate, because there were people that were from other backgrounds, you know, criminal backgrounds, who were Category A prisoners there. But they were caring individuals in relation to two women being among 800 men. For some of the other criminal population, it was appalling behaviour. So that was for 13 months of that. And then on top of it, we were strip searched. It first of all began one or two a day and ended up at six strip searches every day. So it was a very invasive sexual environment, you know, that you felt that you were held within. That both, and then as well as that, it didn't bother me as much, the body searches. You were body searched at every move you made. Ella hated to touch on her body. I think because we were used to, and it shows you how you probably do get used to going through checkpoints and whatever and being searched. But Ella found that really offensive, how they would search us. And so between the body searches and the strip searches and the sexual abuse that we endured for 13 months, it was near impossible to prepare for your trial, because you're just trying to survive mentally. We knew that if we continued to react in the manner that we were acting, that's where it was going to lead. So we kept having to counsel ourselves, talk to ourselves, talk to each other, and take it in the chin that this was it. And we thought that was as bad as it was going to get until we were sentenced and we moved from the fire in the frying pan, because we moved from Brixton Prison into Durham Jail.
And Martina, that sexual violence that you and Ella suffered in Brixton, it was bad enough what you suffered at the hands of other prisoners, but tell us a wee bit more about the strip searches. Would that have been one or two people carrying those out? Were there ever women involved in them, or how many people would have been involved in a strip search, and what was that like?
You were put in the middle of a room and they circled you.
How many?
Six screws, and they circled you. So when they circled you, they put you in the middle, like you were in a circus.
Six of them,
and they would take off your clothes bit by bit, and they would make comments about your body. I remember one day I literally came off a visit. I had that experience, put on my clothes, and I got to the cell door and they put their hand up. They says, now we're just going to strip you again, because we're now going to do this as a cell search. I literally hadn't left the room. Mm-hmm. So we knew that they were physically and mentally trying to break us. And it wasn't easy. You know, it wasn't an easy 13 months. It was a tough 13 months. And when we got to Durham, that was our first experience when we walked in the door again, was to be strip searched. We were strip searched when we left Brixton. We were put into the back of a van. We had in contact with nobody but screws. And we came into Durham and we were stripped again. So it continued throughout.
Were other prisoners in Durham, were the other women prisoners strip searched, or was that exclusive to you and Ella?
Generally speaking, because we were what they regarded as high-risk category prisoners, they subjected us to more strip searches than anyone in the jail, either in Durham or in Brixton. Even the men were not getting the same treatment as we were. So there was a sexual connotation attached to it, because it wasn't just something that they were going to apply to category prisoners, regardless of if you were a male or female.
So just moving forward a bit then, and then your eventual release, Martina, you then joined Sinn Féin. Was that an easy transition after all those years in jail?
Yeah, it was a natural transition. We had followed the political process throughout. We were sent back here, transferred to prisons in Ireland 6 weeks before the first IRA cessation. I remember Martin telling me that this was part of what the British were trying to do to send a signal. We had historical meetings with the ANC. The South Africans came to Longkesh prison, and we women in Armagh were brought there. We were regularly updated about the peace and political process and what was going on in negotiations. As political prisoners, I was released under the terms of the Good Friday Agreement. My husband, who I married in jail, it's another story, he had subsequently been released after me. Jack Straw tried to prevent him and two other men getting out because they were the only prisoners that were subjected to natural life. They were never to be released. And so the natural corollary of me was to become involved in Sinn Féin. Was it to be an elected rep? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. And I toiled with going back to university. Going to university, I didn't have a university experience, but in prison I studied after having... We had a whole battle in our hands to get be allowed to study and whatever, but I ended up getting a first-class honours degree with an open university course. I went into jail with no academic qualifications, and I came out with a number of A-levels and O-levels and then on to university degrees. We had no notions of going down and embarking upon that road. I always had seen myself as an activist, but very much as a non-elected activist until... Mary Nillis had stood down and I was to replace her, and I refused to do so. I was at that stage, my position in the All-Ireland coordinator, I was working on that. I had been working in the assembly, and they used to slag me and say, she thinks she's Miss All-Ireland. I loved being in that position. And so I refused to go into the assembly, and then Mitchell McLaughlin was moved into another constituency. And they asked me four times to stand, and I was not doing it. And then Mark McGuinness came and asked me. And we all know we don't say no to Martin.
And I worked with you and served alongside you in the assembly, and you were brilliant and so hardworking and so across all the detail. But I thought you really shone when you went to Europe. You were a powerhouse in Europe, and I credited you with the reason that the Europeans knew so much about Ireland and the implications of Brexit would have. So tell us about your time as an MEP, will you?
Barbara de Bruin stood down in 2012, unexpectedly and for personal reasons, and I had been a junior minister to Martin McGuinness, and one of the responsibilities that I had was Europe. So the party thought I knew a thing or two about Europe, and so did I. But I had no intentions of ever going to Europe, like, to be an MEP. So they asked me to take it on, and again, one thing and another, you're persuaded to do it. So I goes over to Europe, and I thought, how am I going to make this place relevant to back here? So the first, I became involved in a lot of jargon, like rapporteur and all that there. You know, it's a lead MEP that's in charge of the file. So the Tobacco Product Directive was something that I got my teeth into as one of the lead MEPs involved in that file. And it was, how do I make... I always try to develop a model, you know, how do I make Europe relevant? So I bring you to Europe and Europe to you. And it was about the amount of people that was dying from it and took on big tobacco, the big tobacco industry. They hated me. I went after them and everything that they had said and the lies that they had told about the product. If it was put in the market now, it wouldn't come on it because 50% of the people who use it die. So I did that, and I got an experience with going to Palestine for the first time in 2013, and I suppose I would describe myself as a nationalist and an internationalist, and you know, I don't think internationalism should be in any way like a buzzword or, you know, a book token. You know, I do believe it's the fire that sort of connects communities struggling for something better, you know, across the world every day in every way. Coming from our experience of conflict in Ireland and going into Palestine to the apartheid wall, demolitions, all that was taking place in the deafening silence of the international community appalled me. And I had an opportunity in 2013 to, in Ramallah, to be at, there was a tranche of prisoners being released. There was 26 prisoners being released, and I stood to right into the middle of the morning waiting on the prisoners to come out. I remember crying, you know, just watching their families and everybody just, you know,